Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. In a moment, I'll talk with someone from the Trust for America's Health about their new report looking at funding for public health. Courtesy of 10TV, Scott Light takes an in-depth look at the coronavirus and efforts to deal with it. Daniel Barnett talks to U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams about smoking. And I'll wrap up the hour talking with Dwayne Casares. He's the CEO of Directions for Youth and Families. First up on Columbus Perspective, joining me on the phone, Dr. Nadine Gracia. She is the Executive Vice President of the Trust for America's Health. How are you?
Doing well. Good morning, Dave.
Thanks for talking to us. Tell us first real quick what the Trust for America's Health is.
Yes, Trust for America's Health is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public health policy, research, and advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. And we work to advance the science and policies that will promote and protect the health of the nation.
And you're out with a new report looking at the funding of public health in America.
That's correct. Our new report, which is called The Impact of Chronic Underfunding on America's Public Health System, looks at federal, state, and local public health spending trends. What our report found is that years of underfunding the public health system has actually made our country vulnerable and puts lives at risk.
So are these the kind of issues that are resulting in states being short on ventilators and that kind of thing, or is it deeper and different than that?
You know, Dave, that's an important question, and that's part of it. You know, sadly, we're seeing the impact of the underfunding of the public health system play out in the COVID-19 pandemic. What we found in this year's report was that there's a mixed picture. You know, there was some funding improvements, but we also found that public health and emergency preparedness systems were dangerously underfunded. For example, more than 20% of states cut their funding between 2018 and 2019. But it's important to understand that a majority of the funding for public health programs in the states and local communities actually comes from the federal government. And so when we see that there is an underfunding of public health starting at the federal level, that has a domino effect that plays out in states and local communities.
You know, I was looking at your report on state funding. In Ohio, it was $165 million in fiscal 2019. A similar state population-wise as Illinois, they were more than twice that. And Alabama, of all places, $265 million. So it seems like the numbers vary widely from state to state.
That's right. We do see variances across states. It's important to note, as an example, that in Ohio, we did see an increase by almost 7% in state public health funding. And it's important to recognize how critical the public health system is. You know, from responding to emergency crises, such as an infectious disease outbreak, to responding to natural disasters that may occur, but also to really ensuring the health and well-being of all residents in a state and addressing issues like chronic disease prevention, issues like diabetes and obesity, to also helping to assure that community conditions really help to promote health and well-being by having, for example, access to affordable, healthy foods and ensuring that communities are walkable and bikeable. These are all of the things that the public health system is engaged in. And what our report is highlighting is that there has, as a nation, that we have been underfunding this system to be able to respond to the multitude of needs. We really have a 20th century public health system trying to respond to 21st century public health needs.
Talking with Dr. Nadine Gracia with the Trust for America's Health, well, it would seem that this pandemic makes things ripe for changing down the line.
That's absolutely right. You know, one of the key thing of understanding is that there are critical emergency needs that need to be addressed now as the nation is responding to this pandemic, and public health is at the front lines. but we cannot allow, once we move through the stages of this pandemic, for us to be in this kind of a situation again. For example, if we look at public health infrastructure, there's expert committees that actually have said that we have underfunded so greatly that now are recommending, for example, that we need about $4.5 billion a year to be invested into the public health system to really help develop those core foundational capabilities to improve the workforce. We've seen, for example, over more than a decade since the last recession, that we lost almost 60,000 positions, about approximately 56,000 public health positions. These are the very individuals that would be on the front lines working to address this COVID-19 pandemic.
Let me ask you this, though. Is there a chance, or do you get a sense at all that perhaps public health in general is kind of on trial right now? Because, there seems to be a fairly loud group of people who are saying that the U.S. has way overreacted on this whole pandemic, and that, businesses have been closed needlessly and such. And a lot of that is at the discretion, it seems, of public health departments in each state.
Well, what we've seen already is the devastating impact that this pandemic has had, certainly in the United States and really across the globe. And that really is a devastating impact for the country. In order to actually try to prevent and further reduce the impact, you have to respond to these types of public health measures like the physical distancing and closures of non-essential businesses, really trusting in the expertise of the science, of the physicians and public health experts whom you have in your state and local public health departments, as well as in our federal agencies, to help guide that process. Otherwise, the impact can be even greater. And when we understand who's even at risk, we know that everyone is at risk for potentially becoming infected with the disease, but we know that there are certain populations that have an even higher risk of the severe outcomes. And so everyone has a role to play in this, and really a part to help actually reduce the spread and reduce the impact on the nation's health.
Well, Ohio has been nowhere near the top in the number of cases, even though we're seventh nationally in population, and the state health director has been very aggressive at urging people to stay at home. It would seem, when you compare Ohio statistics with similar states, that it has certainly made a difference.
Well, that's exactly where having such strong leadership in our state and local public health departments is really very important. And to your point, really helps with regards to providing that type of clear communications and guidance to the residents of the state to understand, especially with a novel virus, where we're learning about this virus every day, and understanding who's at risk, how to better control the spread of the virus. But in order to do this work, it really requires having the resources to be able to do so. And so when we ask, state and local health officials to be able to handle an increasing number of emergencies, they have to be able to have the workforce, the data surveillance systems, the types of communication modalities, and ability to have cooperation across jurisdictions. And that takes investment. And as a nation, again, what we saw in our report on the chronic underfunding of the public health system is that public health has been underfunded for far too long. And so we have to make sure that as we move through this crisis, that yes, one, you provide the emergency funding. So when Congress has passed those emergency bills to provide additional funding to states and local communities to be able to respond to the pandemic, that's critically important, especially in the emergency phase. But what we can't do is repeat what we've done in the past, which is once the emergency ends, then we retract and we actually decrease our funding and support to those state and local public health departments. We have to keep that investment, we have to increase it, and we have to sustain it for the long term.
Dr. Gracia, where can folks find this report?
You can visit the Trust for America's Health website at tfah.org. That's tfah.org.
Dr. Nadine Gracia, she's the Executive Vice President of the Trust for America's Health. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Dave.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com and thanks for listening.
I'm Ohio Governor Mike DeWine. We're at war with the coronavirus, very dangerous and lethal enemy. You can help by staying home. If you must go out, keep 6 feet from other people to protect yourself, people living with you, and others. Every action we take or don't take has a real impact. Ohio, we're in this together.
Furnished by Governor Mike DeWine and the OAB.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Courtesy of 10TV, here is Scott Light from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. Here's Scott.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Face the State on this Sunday morning. I'm Scott Light. You are going to hear a lot of voices this morning on that delicate balance of keeping you safe from COVID-19 while gradually reopening the economy. I talked to both the Buckeye Institute and Policy Matters Ohio about all this. I also continue to talk to Ohio mayors who have a message for all of you that your police, fire, and emergency services will be affected. One mayor was very blunt, saying we're already in a recession. And finally, this morning, we're going to pull back the curtain on some groundbreaking research taking place just down the street at Ohio State. It's research dedicated to producing better doctors, less stressed doctors, and that means better outcomes for you if you do get sick. But let's begin this morning with that balance I mentioned, resuscitating the Ohio economy while continuing to protect you from COVID-19.
More New Yorkers would test positive, had the virus, which means that that probably is true in Ohio. I have stated up here when we looked at what happened at Marion in the prison that we had 39% of the people who had showed no evidence that they were sick, had the virus. So we have always felt that, and Dr. Acton has been very clear all through this, that there are more and more people who have this than ever knew they had it. And many people who had thought they had something else probably had it. So what that does, as you pointed out, is that means that of the people who have it, the percentage of people who die has gone down. That's a natural function of increasing the whole. But it does not change the fact that this is still very contagious. There's no indication that I'm aware of that it stopped being contagious. So percentages are interesting. As we move to open up more of Ohio, get more people back to work, we want to do it in a careful way, and we want to do it in a way that engenders confidence in people.
The reality is that even when you open things back up, it's not going to come back fast. That's from a health point of view, I know that is a welcome sign. From an economic point of view, it's a troubling sign. But that's just the reality. It's not like on May 1 that the things that open up that it's just going to pop back like you're thrown on a light switch. This is going to go very, very gradually, not because of anything that we're doing, but just because of the nature of the economy that you have to, employers slowly bring back people when they get to the financial circumstance they can feel confident in doing that. Customers particularly those with vulnerable health population, vulnerable health populations, are going to come back very slowly. And so we don't expect that on May 1 or May 15th or June 1 that the economic circumstances for those folks, many of them, are going to change all that dramatically.
These are significant decisions that impact people's lives, both from a health point of view and from an economic point of view. And trying to balance those in a way that allows us to continue to move forward and do it in a way that we're not going to have to turn around and go back. We want to start out. We want to move forward. We want to do it in a logical way.
There are obviously a thousand reasons that state and local leaders want to restart the economy, but here's one that mayors across Ohio want to talk about right now. A financial tsunami is building and could come crashing down on your city services. Cities like Toledo and Dayton have already started furloughing their city workers to prepare for all this. Why? Well, take a look at this from the Brookings Institute. It's because of our reliance, and some say over-reliance, on income taxes for local revenue by Ohio cities. Brookings puts four of our cities in the top five nationally for potentially devastating fiscal impacts. The mayor of Toledo told me Brookings is spot on.
We know that at the very least, we're looking at a shortfall of $10 million just for this year. Again, our furloughs are going to help us get through most of that challenge, though we still have more that we need to do. But depending on the scenarios as you run them, the deficit could grow to as large as $50 million by the end of 2021. Now, we won't face a $50 million deficit by the end of this year, but by the end of 2021, we could be looking at a $50 million deficit. We now mathematically are in a recession, or we will be as soon as the second quarter is over. That's not a political statement. That's not subjective. Recessions can be measured objectively, and they are defined as two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. Well, the first quarter saw a small amount of negative economic growth, but negative growth nonetheless. The second quarter, unfortunately, we will see historic record-setting negative economic growth. Some economists believe the economy will contract by 30%. So that means we're in a recession. We are. We always knew that a recession would come one day. That's how our economy works, and it always has. And so all of us, I think, and not just those of us in government, but private sector and individual citizens, knew that there would be a day when the economy would pause. But with every previous recession that we've had, there's been time to prepare for it. There would be warning signs on the horizon, and organizations would sort of be able to trim their sails and start making adjustments. That's not what happened in this case. I mean, it happened like that.
Ohio cities are uniquely vulnerable to the impending economic tsunami because our communities rely primarily on income tax revenue. If Congress fails to include immediate fiscal relief to cities, critical frontline services could be impacted, and Ohio's economic recovery will be severely threatened. This past week on Tuesday, a national survey from over 2,500 cities, including a dozen Ohio cities, was released by the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the National League of Cities. They indicated that most cities will need to consider drawing down reserves, cutting safety services, and raising taxes as potential options to address the fiscal crisis brought on to the coronavirus outbreak.
And I am glad that now there is some coverage being devoted to the impact on cities because it needs to be reported. It is, look, nobody wants to lay off police and fire, but it is, unless we get a lifeline from somewhere, that's going to be a reality, not just in Toledo, but in every city of our state for sure. And soon every city in our country. There's no other way around it. And I know sometimes what happens in Washington, D.C. seems so far away. It seems far from our daily lives, and often people wonder, well, what does any of their arguing and bickering have to do with me? Well, if your local police officer or firefighter or trash collector gets laid off during this crisis, well, then you bet it does affect you. And that's the message that cities are trying to get across to the White House and to Congress as they debate these rescue bills.
Like many cities, Lancaster doesn't have a rainy day fund to cushion the impact of this revenue loss. 78% of our general fund income is from income taxes and a local government fund. The local government fund is based on state tax collections as a percentage. So we're going to see a cut in that area too. So looking at our general fund, 84% of that goes for salaries and benefits, and 70% of the general fund goes for police and fire salaries and benefits. So the safety forces, no doubt, are going to feel a disproportionate impact of that. We're looking at possibly laying off as many as 20% of our safety forces, police and fire, which would impact safety of our cities, response times for EMT runs, et cetera. If we do not get some fiscal relief, it's going to impact the city of Lancaster for many years.
And I get it. There are a lot of needs. The small business program had to be replenished, and healthcare workers need relief. I get it. There's a lot of needs. But cities are running out of time. And in the next bill, which we're told will be debated sometime in May, there's not meaningful relief for the cities of this country. You will see police officers laid off, firefighters laid off, and I just can't imagine there is a congressman or senator in Washington who wants to see that happen or wants that placed at their feet. So I know Washington will do right by America's cities because they don't want to be on the hook for police and firefighters being laid off. But that's what will happen if we don't see something happen in this next bill.
And we'll certainly keep talking to mayors here on Face the State.
When I grow up, I want to be a doctor, because that's a really important job. I would help kids get better and make everything super fun. I'd have a cool waiting room with games, toys, and a huge TV.
If your child is sick over and over again, it could be PI, a serious defect of the immune system. Early testing gives children a chance to dream.
And I'll give every kid a cherry lollipop, because that's the best flavor!
Jeffrey Modell Foundation, helping children reach for their dreams. Visit info4pi.org.
Our connections make powerful things happen, uniting individuals and communities. We are Rotary. We are people of action. And together, we turn great ideas into reality by accessing our networks, our experience, and the best of ourselves to make a difference. Around the world, Rotary brings leaders together to build new friendships and to solve problems. Like in Austria, where generations work side by side to build sustainable housing and community centers. In India, volunteers run a mobile blood bank to help provide a steady blood supply for their local community. And in Taiwan, people are working hard to get vulnerable citizens the support and services they need. With over 1 million members, we know what people can do when they come together. Take action with us. Find out more at rotary.org/action.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
180 over 111, and I had a stroke.
145 over 92, and then I had a heart attack.
150 over 90, and I had a stroke.
This is what high blood pressure sounds like. You might not feel its symptoms, but the results from a heart attack or stroke are far from silent. Get back on your treatment plan or talk with your doctor to create a plan that works for you. Go to loweryourhbp.org.
Everything's changed.
Brought to you by the American Heart Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Back to Scott Light, courtesy of 10TV. By the way, in this segment, Scott's guests include Greg Lawson from the Buckeye Institute and Hannah Halbert from Policy Matters, Ohio.
Welcome back. Normally, when we have guests, it's always interesting to take a policy issue and then let conservatives, moderates, and liberals kind of hash it out here through their respective thoughts and experience. So I talked to left-leaning Policy Matters, Ohio, and right-leaning Buckeye Institute about how this recovery should proceed and just how much government intervention is necessary. Buckeye Institute.
I think it's unprecedented, certainly in modern economic history. When you think about things like the Great Depression, or you think about the Great Recession that we just went through over a decade ago, those had unique attributes, but they were economic based, and there were issues that then reverberated out, and government policy maybe made it better in some cases or made it worse in other cases, but it wasn't the cause of things. And I think that's what's so strikingly different here is there's never been a time that I can think of where the government has literally said, shut things down. And that's a big challenge, and that's hard to kind of wrestle with, really, because it's so broad. And I think that obviously the desire to protect folks and to make sure everyone is safe, we stop the spread or at least flatten the curve and do all the things that we've heard so much about in the last few weeks, we understand it. It makes a lot of sense. And the economy can't function if people are freaking out either. And that's one of the big balancing acts we're going to have as things try to slip back into a more normal pace.
Policy Matters Ohio.
The important thing for policymakers to do and to keep in mind is that, you know, we really do have to keep people first in this crisis. And if we do that, then a lot of these answers will sort of answer themselves, right? So we know that as we think about reopening the state, some of the questions we need to be asking are, what are the protections for workers in the front line, in our grocery stores, in bars and restaurants, in all of these industries that start to come online? What are the protections, and how can we enforce those protections as well? If workers aren't safe, if customers don't believe that they're safe, there's no amount of speedy reopening that's going to get us out of the recession. We have to have a smart approach that's guided by public health experts, and that really does put the safety of Ohioans first.
The other thing about this, our national economy, state economy, neither one are spigots. You can't just turn the knob and open it full blast, right?
That's right. And it's especially true at the state level. You know, we actually at the Buckeye Institute released kind of a paper about what you could do for state budget reductions, because we have the rainy day fund, of course, I would envision that some of that will be used in some fashion. I'm not sure yet how it's going to be done. But the state, it can't print money. It can't do what the Federal Reserve does at the national level. And it doesn't have, it has pretty strict debt requirements. So, and you have a constitutional requirement to have a balanced budget. So you factor all those things in, and it's kind of a fiscal straitjacket. And that's appropriate in most normal times so that you have responsible government that doesn't go off the rails on spending. But it's obviously a massive challenge when we're dealing with something like today because the tax revenues are already coming in over $100 million lower. And it's going to, again, as the job numbers continue to get worse, the tax revenue numbers are going to get worse. And Ohio actually is probably even worse off than most states because of the way that local governments get funded.
A lot of that support is going to have to come from the federal government. Just the state of Ohio cannot run a deficit, so we're constrained on how much at the state level we can put forward. So the bulk of this support is going to have to come from the federal government, and it really should continue until we see conditions on the ground change. So we shouldn't be looking for ways to cut unemployment or pandemic unemployment compensation early or shortchange state and local budgets from that federal support. That's the biggest lift. But the state does have tools available. We do have the rainy day fund. We just put out a paper today that talks about the TANF surplus. So this is money, over $500 million available that could be spent to provide emergency cash assistance to families. So the state does have some untapped tools at its disposal to help make sure that Ohioans aren't having to make this choice between putting their health and safety at risk or keeping food on the table or a roof over their head.
Still ahead this morning, it's important in these stressful times to take a moment to breathe in and out and to be mindful about everything that we're all dealing with. If you struggle with that, there is certainly help out there. We are bringing together some of the experts out there to help you in what we're calling a mindful moment. Some of the leading research in the country is happening right here in town at Ohio State University. Dr. Mariana Klatt has put together 5-minute videos for doctors to help them better treat patients, to bring their stress level down. Well, now she's sharing those mindfulness techniques with us and with you.
We are going to do some daily practices for frontline providers and for anybody else who needs some anxiety relief during this very stressful time. The thing is, we absolutely cannot put off resiliency building. We have to do it now, and we have to do it all through COVID-19. Because we can do this, and believing that we can do this is pivotal. So every day there's going to be a new 5-minute practice to help whoever is open to this through the anxiety, the fear, the uncertainty, from just accessing our breath within our own bodies and the ability to shift our mind towards believing that we can get through this. So we'll do a lot of body work, a lot of breathing. So if everybody could just sit in a chair that's comfortable, not a squishy chair, but a harder chair, but still one that's comfortable. Looking down at your feet and just relaxing your feet within your shoes. Noticing the temperature inside your shoes. And just dropping your feet into the floor, into your shoes and into the floor. Take a deep breath in through your nose. And exhale through your lips.
We just started these segments this past week, and we're putting them on our website at 10tv.com/mindfulmoment. You know what? Anyone can be mindful, and there is a growing body of data and studies out there showing that it's helping everyone, from soldiers with post-traumatic stress to doctors to CEOs to everyday people like you and me. So stay safe, stay healthy, and get outside.
That's again Scott Light, courtesy of 10TV, from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. Still to come in about 12 minutes, Dwayne Casares, CEO of Directions for Youth and Families.
These are unprecedented times, challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency childcare, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan.
Thank you for staying tuned to Columbus Perspective. I'm Daniel Barnett. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, along with the U.S. Surgeon General's Office, released a report on the importance of quitting smoking. It's the 34th Surgeon General's report on tobacco use, but it's the first time in nearly 3 decades that the report focused solely on quitting smoking. I have on the line with me today the U.S. Surgeon General himself, Dr. Jerome Adams, as well as Beatrice, who is a former smoker that is part of the CDC's campaign in which former smokers give tips to current smokers on how to kick the habit. Dr. Adams, Beatrice, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Appreciate you giving us the opportunity.
So, Dr. Adams, let's start with the report itself. Can you give us a little bit of background on this report and some of the key findings within?
Well, thank you for having us. And first off, I want people to know that 34 million Americans are still smoking, and that's a problem because we know that smoking is the number one preventable cause of early death, disease, and disability in the United States. My new report details the science that we've accumulated over the last 30 years regarding what we know works to help people quit.
And as I understand it, this report is about tobacco use, not just nicotine use. Was there any consideration of the role that e-cigarettes play in smoking?
Well, there have been several Surgeon General reports talking about the benefits of not initiating smoking. This report talks about the benefits of quitting smoking. And in order to have that conversation, we absolutely had the over 150 experts who helped compile and edit this report look at the data that's out there on e-cigarettes. They came to the conclusion that there is currently inadequate evidence to infer that e-cigarettes help people quit smoking in general. That's not to discount individual accounts that we've got that we've received from people about how they've used e-cigarettes to help them quit. But this is a diverse and rapidly changing landscape. We have thousands of products out there, and right now there just isn't enough evidence to say with the weight of the science that e-cigarettes help people quit smoking in general. But we do know what does help people quit. FDA-approved quit medications, behavioral counseling, policy interventions like smoke-free laws and increasing the cost of tobacco. And so we're really trying to help folks understand there are an array of evidence-based tools, resources, and policies out there that when enacted, help people quit.
Once again, I have U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams on the line, as well as Beatrice, a former smoker who's featured in the CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. Beatrice, let's turn to you for a minute. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences both with smoking and then eventually with quitting smoking?
Yes, sure. I started smoking at a pretty young age, and as I got older, I got married and had children. It started to affect my family. My smoking was affecting my family. And my son, one of my boys, Nicholas, wrote me a letter asking me to quit smoking because he knew it's bad for you. And when I got that letter and I read it, I got pretty emotional and I realized it's time to quit. And I had tried several attempts to quit, and I wasn't successful at every one. But the last motivating factor was my son asking me to quit smoking. And so I sought help. I got nicotine replacement therapy, and also I saw my doctor and I asked for help, and she prescribed something to help me with that, with quitting.
I feel like quitting smoking is such an individual experience. Some things work for some people and not for others. Did you have any contact with other people who were quitting smoking and the kinds of things that worked or didn't work for them?
I actually don't have anybody that I can compare my situation to. My brother, actually, he quit smoking, but his situation was different. He did it cold turkey, and that's the only thing I can compare it to is my brother, but his was a different situation than mine. And I think everyone's situation is pretty unique, and they have to find what motivates them and stick to it and just seek help.
And what I would say to folks as the Surgeon General is on CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. You can see stories and hear stories from an array of people who've quit smoking at cdc.gov/tips. I think it's powerful. It's powerful to hear from old people, young people, parents, folks who don't have kids, an array of individuals, some with disease, some with no disease, who just want to be healthier, tell their stories about why they quit and how they quit, because everyone's story is a little bit different. But this report is about looking at all the science that's out there and putting each of these individuals in the best possible situation to quit.
And obviously those full resources are out there for people to look at. Can you talk a little bit about some of the tips that are given in that report and some of the things that, maybe some of the interesting stories that were gleaned from putting it together?
Absolutely. Well, number one, I would tell people to go to smokefree.gov for more information about quitting smoking. Every state also has a quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That you can call into and speak to someone about quitting smoking. You can get counseling. You can also get referrals to medications that will help you quit smoking. But some of the tips that we gleaned from the report and some of the stats that, stuck out to me, there are certain groups who are still disproportionately affected by smoking. The LGBTQ community, American Indian, Alaska Native, disproportionately affected. And this one here really stuck with me. 40% of the combustible cigarettes in this country are consumed by people with a mental illness or a substance use disorder diagnosis. 40%. So we need to give those folks the tools that we know quit. And what do we know works? We know that there are 7 FDA-approved medications and behavioral counseling that when used in concert, double the success rates for people who make a quit attempt. But unfortunately, only about a third of people who try to quit are doing so with the aid of FDA-approved medications.
Can we talk a little bit more about those groups? They seem to be marginalized groups or groups that are already marginalized in society. Can you shed any light on why they might be more likely to smoke or to keep smoking?
Well, that's one of the things that we're continuing to dig in, but we know that there's a stigma attached to smoking and there's a stigma attached to certain subgroups. We know that in many cases, folks chalk it up to, hey, they've got bigger problems, bigger fish to fry, and we don't want to take something away from them. But the studies have shown consistently that people's physical health and mental health improves when they stop smoking. And that includes people with mental illnesses and substance use disorders. They're more successful in treatment if they actually quit smoking. These folks want to quit and they can quit, but we just need to get over this bias that we tend to have in regards to whether or not we offer those services. And another stat that, stuck out to me, 60% of people who are smoking who see a doctor get advised to quit, which means that 40% of smokers who see a healthcare professional are not advised to quit. So we need to make sure folks know which groups are most affected. We need to advise them to quit. We need to give them the tools to help them quit. And then we need to provide an environment around them. Smoke-free policies, payment for FDA-approved medications that will give them the resources and tools that will help them be successful.
And this might seem like an obvious question, but I think it's worth putting out there. What are the specific benefits of quitting smoking?
Well, we detail that in the report. For the first time ever, 12 different cancers, your chance of developing those cancers is lessened if you quit. COPD and cardiovascular disease, those are lessened if you quit. We also know that reproductive health, everything from fertility to erectile dysfunction, is improved if you actually quit smoking. So many benefits from a physical health point of view. But smoking costs our country also $300 billion every year, which is about $1,000 for every man, woman, and child. So quitting smoking isn't just good for our physical health. It's also good for our fiscal health.
Dr. Adams, one more time, if you would let folks know where they can find more resources to quit smoking.
If you or a loved one want to quit smoking, right now you can pick up your phone and dial 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Or if you have a smartphone or access to the internet, go to smokefree.gov. Two great resources with lots of tips that will help you on your journey to become smoke-free.
Once again, I've been speaking with U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, talking about the smoking cessation report, and Beatrice, a former smoker who's featured in the CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. Thank you both for speaking with me today and for all you're doing to help folks kick the habit.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
We'll be back with more on Columbus Perspective in just a moment.
Our military service members volunteer to protect us in the most dangerous places around the world. They step up. And when they are severely ill or injured, returning to their families is only the beginning of their long road home. Wounded Warrior Project provides these brave men and women whatever they need to continue their fight for independence at no cost for life. So now it's time for a grateful nation to step up. Join us at findwwp.org.
When I grow up, I want to be a baseball player. I would be the pitcher because they get to do something all the time.
If your child is sick over and over again, it could be PI, a defect in the immune system that affects millions. Early detection can give children a chance to dream.
Jeffrey Modell Foundation, 25 years of helping children reach for their dreams. Visit us at info4pi.org or call 1-866-info4pi.
Long ago, you wouldn't think of galloping on a horse while doing calligraphy, and you wouldn't have attempted to ride your bike while typing a letter. Yet you think you can safely operate a multi-ton vehicle while texting? Behind the wheel is no place to multitask. If you want to BRB, drive now and text later. Lives depend on it.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Hi, this is Dave James. Joining me on the phone is Dwayne Casares. He's the CEO of Directions for Youth and Families. How you doing, Dwayne?
I'm good, Dave.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it. We are now, I guess, five, 6 weeks into this stay-at-home policy that's going on. And how are things at Directions for Youth and Families?
We're good. We've transitioned to telehealth, so we have all of our therapists and counselors working remotely from home, so they're using telehealth because of the stressors that we know that this is putting on families. We remain open, in a sense, for all of our counseling services, so we'll give numbers at the end of the show in case anybody has needs. We are still opening cases for people to try to support them. We know this is just weighing heavy on everybody. I mean, everybody's kind of suffering in this together. Our two after-school centers, they had to close because of the numbers and the restrictions and guidelines. We are delivering meals out of those two locations, so many of the people that we serve don't necessarily have access to the food pantries or distribution centers or even transportation, so we are serving meals out of both of those centers, doing both lunch and dinner. I have to give a shout out to the whole group. We are in this together, which is a group that was started by Jenny's Ice Cream and Homage and Hot Chicken Takeover, Roosevelt House, and I'm Pelotonia. All those CEOs formed a group, and they're buying meals, in a sense, from restaurants and then giving them to places like our after-school center so that we can then distribute these takeout meals to the people in those communities. So it's really great to see people pulling together and doing things like this for the better good of all of us. I mean, all of us are in this together.
That is one of the things that I guess to be grateful for when a nation, and the world for that matter, goes through something like this, is that there's going to be an awful lot of heartwarming stories that come out of it, and you really kind of start to see what makes people tick.
Yeah, it's like humans being humans. I mean, you all of a sudden, all the other crap that we use, am I allowed to say that on the air?
I think so, yeah.
Well, really, all the other stuff that we, you know, botch our minds up with and get stressed over or angry about or all these types of things, they have really become secondary because of all the suffering that we see around us, all the challenges, and it's new for everyone. No one is exempt from this, so you almost get to see a greater human quality, I think, and that's kind of refreshing and grateful. You even look at when you look at some of these other things, our Earth is healing in a sense because there's not as much toxic stuff going out into it. So, you know, there's some very positive things that you can look at this, but it certainly is a struggle for everyone.
You mentioned that you're a counseling agency for kids and families, and you're doing this by telehealth. Yeah. So is that mainly by phone, by computer? I guess it depends on what a family is able to do, right?
Yeah, it really depends on the hardware that they may have at their homes. I mean, even data plans, although we've increased all of our data plans to kind of cover that. It is a bit of a challenge, so but we're still being able to reach people as long as they have the equipment, and it can even be they've just recently added texting to that because some of our families do not have access to video stuff, and we're using everything, whether it's FaceTime or there's things I never even heard. Discord, I guess a lot of people use Discord Kids. Didn't even know what that was. I have House Party now. What a fun thing. So I just feel like I'm just growing up so much. All of us in the business world, I think Zoom has become like a major thing that all of us are using. So we use all these with our kids as well.
Talking with Dwayne Casares, CEO, Directions for Youth and Families. There was a report that came out a few days ago that child abuse reports are
way, way down. And the reason, the thinking behind it is people on the front lines of noticing and, you know, trying to do something about it are teachers and people who normally have the ear of kids who don't anymore.
Yeah, that gets real concerning. That's one of the other things that, you know, this thing has brought out. Things are can really help happen in isolation. Those things do bother me. It's the things that I think that we all should be concerned about, because of the lack of contact with everyone. These things can actually still be going on. There's just no avenue for them to be reported or seen. So all the more, and this increased stress on everyone that we're being confined to our homes. Parents are being asked to teach their children, with some of them just that's a whole new role for them to play. There's challenges even with those systems, so the stress on families has certainly increased.
And, you know, anger would be a running theme through a lot of that, which I guess now more than ever, the importance of being able to control that is there.
Yeah, you know, and you have to do that. We talked about this before. You're about as dumb as you're possibly going to be when you're angry. So that's not the time to try to have a discussion. So we have talked about facts that at times timeouts are very helpful. And for me, timeouts are just as important, if not more important, for the adults in the household or for family or for parents than it is for kids. It's a time for both of you to regroup. You got to be able to take some space and get away from each other. Not all environments, not, you know, small apartments aren't going to allow that. So all the more reason to make sure that you have certain things in place where you can express your anger appropriately, and that you do have outlets. And I think these outlets have to be, if anything, we have to be more in tune to them. You know, exercise is a huge outlet for everyone. With the closing of the gyms, for many people, I know at least for me, that's a big thing to drop off. I mean, I started all my days like at 5:30 in the gym, and to not have that now, that's I know that sounds like whining, but that's been a huge adjustment for me. So making sure that you're replacing that with other things like other physical activity, getting exercises, going for walks safely, of course, you know, respecting the social distancing. I think dogs across the country or across the world are thrilled that they're getting so many walks in now. But I think these things are important.
The changes from one household to another, it's pretty amazing, because you've got the elderly who may be counting on that one visit per day, week, month, whatever they were getting before, who may not be getting it. And then you've got families who aren't used to having all four members in the house together all the time, who maybe just want to be alone once in a while.
Right. So I think what is good is to make a list of things. And, you know, sometimes we're just reacting to things instead of being planful. So in a proactive way, I think you can put together a list like, so what happens when I'm feeling, you know, anxious or I can feel my anger coming up. And with all of us I have clues to do that. So I have my list. I'll pull out my list so that way I can go through it. So one of my list is like listening to music. I'm going to start to read a book. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to visit with a family member. I mean, if you have access to that, or at least even call somebody on the phone. I'm going to play with the dog. I'm going to watch a comedy film. And so I think if you can come up with these things, there's many things you can do, especially with the internet. You can learn a new skill. I was reading something the other day that I think it was on a Reddit thread about new skills you can learn. And one of the easiest is to learn to pick locks. Now, I don't think we should encourage this, but I found that fascinating. I thought, wow, that would be something new. And somebody said, one of the people said you could learn this like in 20 minutes. And I thought, it humored me, but you really could learn these things. You'll learn a new language. You can help somebody in trouble. You can talk about, I will say, the last show we did, we talked about calling people who were perhaps individuals or living alone. I did get grief right after the show, Dave. I got a text from a friend of mine who said, I live alone, and you didn't call me.
Ah, so, there you go.
he called me out, like, right as soon as the show ended. So I probably should call him this week.
Talking with Dwayne Cassara, CEO, Directions for Youth and Families. Well, this is a really difficult time for kids right now, especially, I'm thinking. Tell us about some aspects of that that maybe we don't know about.
Food is still a concern. If you look, one of the biggest things that's why we want, we are committed to serving meals out of our centers. People need to have access to food. You look at you and I, look at the typical person, we're eating through our food at home. What do you think kids are doing that are now home from school? And there are some people that don't have the resources that others have, so they're eating through their food a lot quicker, and access to that and affordability of that is really a challenge through all of this, and we have to be mindful of those very, very basic needs that are critical.
You know, that's an interesting point, too, because I've talked to other people who are working at home now and eating more, and it's out of boredom and stress. And, you know, for folks who live in poverty, that is a daily occurrence all the time, and now this is added on top of it.
Yes, many people use food in a sense of self-medication. I mean, they use that to calm themselves down or soothe or to replace whatever. But that has to mean that you have access to that. Not everybody has that. So being mindful of that, reaching out to your neighbors, you know, making sure that people do have those things. I actually think our community is doing a pretty good job of that. You've seen other places where food lines are extremely, extremely long. I think everybody's really mobilizing to do these kinds of things. We are grateful, again, like for people like we are all in this together, that whole movement, to make sure that people are fed.
You mentioned some of the ways to erase some of that boredom or stress. Any other ideas along that line?
Yeah, you know, I think like just even learning certain things, learning to play an instrument. I think everyone's going to come out of this thing maybe being a better chef, being creative in the kitchen. I've seen so many people like baking bread that have never baked things before. Trying something new. You can go to the gym, but there's a lot of body mindful exercises you can do. Starting yoga. There's many things that you could take on. I'd encourage everybody to try to learn something new. Use this opportunity to expand yourselves in other ways, and by doing that, you're also addressing your own development, your own stress level. It's all a part of centering and balancing and adjusting to this new normal.
Dwayne Cassara, CEO, Directions for Youth and Families. Just a couple of minutes to go here, Dwayne. What about kids who maybe are, you know, some of them that you would be serving who maybe have some level of social dysfunction or problems relating on one level or another, who now may be with a totally different environment than what they're comfortable in?
Change is difficult for anyone, whether it's a kid or an adult. We all are creatures of habit. We like patterns. When we don't get that, it starts to trigger many different things. That's why having some type of new set pattern is important. I think you have to make sure you look at things from a cognitive, emotional, behavioral standpoint and start developing your new pattern. When we have patterns, they make us more comfortable because they're predictable. And in predictability, there's a sense of safety. And now more than any time, we all need to be able to feel that way. And I just think it's critically important that we look at those things.
If folks want more information about your agency, Dwayne, what do they do?
They can check us out on the web at www.dfyf.org. By the way, as long as I'm mentioning that, every day at 10, if you're bored with your kids at home, you can get on our website or look at us on Facebook or Instagram, maybe, I don't know, YouTube. We do have a YouTube channel. But we actually have our after-school staff doing things like art projects or learning dance moves or learning some type of fitness skill. I think the other day they did basketball. There's my mindfulness. We have one of our people doing yoga. So each day we do something different. You can certainly get in front, at least at that point. You can tap into these. You don't have to sign on at 10 o'clock. But these are made available so that these are other things that you can just start to have as part of your pattern to build these things in. We want to do these to still help the people in the community. And as I said, our referral lines are still open for if you're feeling stressed or don't know what to do or want us to start working with you and your family together and something that's come up while we're all in this new state. You can call us at 614-294-2661.
All right. Thanks for your time, Dwayne. Good luck.
Thank you. Thanks, Dave. Take care.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.